ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's The Music Show on ABC Radio National, and we're listening to the sound of Bob Dylan. Well, one of the sounds. I read a book some time ago by the Oxford Professor of Music. It was called Bob Dylan's Visions of Sin, and it was 500-600 pages long, and it was all about Milton and Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot. When people write about Dylan, they tend to write about Dylan's words. Stephen Rings has written a book about Bob Dylan's sound. It's called What Did You Hear? The Music of Bob Dylan. And it's a very detailed look at that sound, how the imperfections are among the most expressive elements in this 60-something year career.
This place ain't doing me any good. I'm in the wrong town. I should be in Hollywood. Just for a second now, I thought I saw something move. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool here would think you've got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy, times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Things Have Changed, that's the song that Bob Dylan wrote for the Curtis Hanson film Wonder Boys, and it's probably the most appropriate song we could begin with to talk about this book, What Did You Hear? The Music of Bob Dylan, with Stephen Rings, because Dylan's always changing. Stephen Rings, welcome to The Music Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the song which you say in the book opened nearly every show that Dylan did from 2013 to 2019. He's performed it now more than 1,000 times. So it's actually one of his most performed songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And as I mentioned there, it's a delectable irony that has to be intentional, that this was an era when set lists became very static. Things didn't change, actually. And this was a real departure from how he'd been on the Neverending Tour for decades before, which is a lot of change from night to night in terms of which songs were played. So, yeah, kind of a sly. I mean, again, he zigs when you expect him to zag, I suppose.
He certainly does. That's right. Yes, there's nothing predictable about Dylan. During those concerts, though, whilst the set list might have remained fairly constant in contrast to his usual modus operandi, which is to sort of dig randomly through the 600 plus songs and pull out things that nobody had heard for years, were the versions of the songs altering?
Yeah, for sure. It's almost kind of a Brownian motion of, you know, on one night, this song is going to change and it settles into a new arrangement for the next 6 months, but the others stay the same. But then a few weeks later, maybe this other one starts to shift. So, you know, one way to view this particular era in the 2010s is that he's keeping the set list fixed so that he can explore more and more different arrangements, different nuances for how he delivers a line and so forth. I should say things have changed very little in terms of arrangement. It was always kind of an up-tempo number. It always struck me, frankly, as sort of a throat-clearing number. I mean, that's figuratively and kind of literally. Often Dylan in these years takes a little while to find his voice on a given night, and things have changed was often a chance for sort of revving the engine, I guess, and getting the vocal folds, like, moving again.
Speaking of things changing, your book is a bit of a change because there's a huge Dylan literature. I mean, massive amount of paper has been printed with Dylan lit on it, but they're nearly all about the lyrics. This is a, you know, Nobel Prize winner for literature, not for music. And so a book about the music of Bob Dylan is a very unusual thing. Before we start talking about specific songs, perhaps you could say something about why you wanted to do that.
This is precisely why I wanted to write the book. It's not the only book on Dylan's music. There's a lovely book by Larry Starr from a few years ago that does talk about it. And Greil Marcus has always talked about his music, but in his characteristically extravagant critical way, doing loop-de-loops historically and interpretively based on one little detail in a performance. But it was amazing to me that this is a person who is arguably, and I think I would argue this, the most recorded musician of the post-war era. He's more bootlegged than any other musician. He has released 80-some albums, depending on how one counts. And yet, there was so little critical discourse on his music. It's not hard to understand why there wouldn't be much published on his music from someone whose stock in trade is literature, from a literary scholar or something. That makes good sense. But it was puzzling to me why more music people hadn't talked about Dylan. But then eventually it became clear why. On the one hand, he's such an idiosyncratic musician, and music scholars aren't used to talking about idiosyncratic musicians. They're used to talking about people who are more legible within traditions of virtuosic performance, whether it's in popular music or classical music or blues or whatever. So that's one reason. The other reason is a widespread opinion that his music is too simple to sustain analytical attention at any length. So, you know, music scholars have come up with all sorts of ways to talk about fancy chords and fancy forms and fancy counterpoint and whatnot. And Bob Dylan doesn't have much of that. And then what he does have as a musician is this wild diversity of performances of the songs from night to night, from year to year, and so forth, about which music scholars sort of look at their shoes and like, boy, I don't really know what to say about that at all. Like, it turns out that's not the melody, I guess. Like, he's singing something different, and I don't really have critical tools to deal with that. So that really intrigued me. I was also just at root fascinated by the fact that Dylan's fans, many of whom I've gotten to know well, I mean, many of whom I've gotten to know some Dylan fans really well, they love his music. They don't, like, just sit down with the printed lyrics and a cup of tea and read the printed lyrics. They listen and listen and listen, and they are connoisseurs of the littlest sonic detail. the hitch in the voice here, or a strumming, interesting timing issue there. They love these things, and they love to debate them and compare different performances. And I was so fascinated by the fact that this is a musician who in so many ways doesn't have the level of professional polish that we tend to expect of a lot of musicians. And yet the music is extraordinarily powerful for millions of people. And so that seems to me a question that people in music studies should be interested in.
Yes.
How does that work?
Yes. I mean, it is remarkable that the sound of Dylan has been ignored so much when, for most people, including people who don't like Dylan, it's the sound which is the most distinctive thing about him.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He is instantly recognizable, love or hate him.
Yeah, and yet the sound keeps changing, and it's been changing since the mid-1960s.
Yeah, that's right.
And it continues to change, and it's not just that he has good nights and bad nights, that the entire vocal persona shifts. Maybe we could talk about the voice, but perhaps we should do it in the context of a song so that we can hear him and hear him sing a song more ways than one. Let's begin with the original version of Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Bob Dylan singing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, one of his early songs, and the perhaps main subject of this book, What Did You Hear? In fact, the title, What Did You Hear?, comes from the song. It's about the music of Bob Dylan. It's by Stephen Rings, and Stephen Rings is my guest on today's music show. That song, I think perhaps most Dylan fans knew that it was based on the song Lord Randall, but you identify two more sources.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I point out is that the opening two lines are obviously related to the text of Lord Randall. In most versions circulating in the folk revival in the 60s, that song would have begun.
Oh, where have you been, Lord Randall, my son? Oh, where have you been, my handsome young one?
It's obvious, like anyone can see, that where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? Is a rewriting of that. Musically, though, the song resembles no other circulating version of Lord Randall that I've found. So there is no instance of the tune that resembles the tune that Dylan sings. So I surveyed dozens of commercial recordings, field recordings, and so forth, just to confirm. And then I went to this massive book by Bertrand Bronson, collects all of the different melodic variants of these child ballads, they're called, of which Lord Randall is one. And he has over 100 variants, and none of them resembles Dylan's. So the musical sources I point to are a few. One is this Woody Guthrie song, 1913 Massacre. The opening line of 1913 Massacre is essentially identical to how Dylan sings the opening line of Hard Rain.
Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country.
Dylan had already reworked 1913 Massacre into a song called Song to Woody.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down, I'm seeing your world of people and things. Here, paupers and peasants and princes and kings.
So you can hear a progression directly from Woody Guthrie singing 1913 Massacre, Bob Dylan singing the same song, we have recordings of him singing 1913 Massacre, and then Song to Woody, and then Hard Rain. And when you put them all back to back, it's pretty hard to miss. It's obvious. Even though Dylan himself said, there was no real tune to it, so I just sort of played some chords without a tune, which is pretty on brand for him to undersell and mumble through an answer about the tune. And I think it's very likely that he didn't consciously think of the tune at all. But at this point in 1962, he's singing a lot of Woody Guthrie. And so it just makes sense that his body would slip into that groove and sing a Guthrie kind of line for the opening. I haven't heard anyone else make that connection. There's one connection that several people have made, which is with the refrain, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain, it's going to fall, comes from a field recording made by the Lomaxes.
It's hard, it's hard, it's hard on
called It's Hard on We Poor Farmers, and the recording is by Lemuel Jones. This is pretty clear. The phrasing is straight out of the Lemuel Jones recording. The more speculative song as an influence that I give for this overall ascent of Hard Rain, this is what it does every verse, is this kind of heroic ascent, is Running Scared, Roy Orbison, which is really, really far from the musical world of Hard Rain.
Just running scared, each place we go, so afraid that he might show.
Yeah, but we know that Bob Dylan loved Roy Orbison. Of course, later he would sing in the 80s with Roy Orbison as part of the Traveling Wilburys, and he writes about Running Scared in Chronicles Volume 1. But I think there is a real clear model here for the kind of step-by-step ascent that we get in Hard Rain with Orbison's operatic pop.
Just running scared.
Just in general, and not specifically in connection with The Hard Rain's Going to Fall, Dylan's musical tastes are incredibly broad, and literary tastes as well. But with every passing year, you sort of discover new enthusiasms that you hadn't realized that Dylan had, but which kind of, in a sense, throw new light on his songwriting. And it's true of the voice as well, isn't it? Which, you know, to quote Dylan, quoting Walt Whitman, contains multitudes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one thing that always made him a bit of a square peg and a round hole in the folk revival was precisely this omnivorous musical appetite, that he was a fan of rock and roll and country and R&B, enthusiastic about all those things without pause. Even when he's in the village at the sort of peak of his topical song years, 1962, 63, he still is metabolizing all sorts of music from up and down the radio dial. And there was a real purism in certain corners of the Greenwich Village folk revival, so this didn't really sit with them. And it didn't sit with him, the idea that he was going to be a purist and sing just the way, as he put it, if you didn't sing it the way Aunt Molly Jackson sang it, they didn't want to hear about it. And he always had a kind of rock and roll energy with his folk performances, too. And a lot of the folk revivalists like that. But as long as it remained with an acoustic guitar, everything was fine. When it comes to voices, absolutely, there is such a range. I mean, most recently we've gotten the kind of Great American Songbook crooner, Bob Dylan, from those records, mostly Sinatra arrangements that he then had arranged for his band and recorded. But we see hints of that voice even on Rough and Rowdy Ways, in the original songs on there. I think of something like Mother of Muses, for example. But earlier, there are other fascinating moments where his voice goes in unusual directions. Everyone puzzles over the voice on Nashville Skyline in 1969, which is his most explicit country record. For those who don't know it, you probably know the song Lay Lady Lay. It's the best known song off of there. And think about what his voice sounds like on there.
Lay lady lay, lay across my big breast bed.
And then compare it to what you just heard on Hard Rain. It's a very different sound, very rounded and smooth. People have often called this a country crooner voice, and I think there's some of that there. But in fact, you can hear him using this voice in a tape from 1960, made when he was still in Minnesota, when his biggest musical enthusiasm is, well, first it's Little Richard, and this isn't quite his Little Richard voice, but then it's Elvis. And it's obvious that it's an Elvis voice. It's like the Love Me Tender Elvis voice. And indeed, he'll later do Blue Moon on Self-Portrait using that voice as kind of an arch send-up of Elvis. So there is that sort of rock and roll crooner voice in there. There's also unusual moments. There's one that I think of from this 1976 record, Desire, the song One More Cup of Coffee, where he has these kind of Middle Eastern sounding or Arabic gestures that he's doing. He loves this Egyptian singer, Umm Kulthum. So there he's, you know, doing a bit of Umm Kulthum.
Your breath is sweet, with your eyes I like two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight, your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. But I don't sense affection. Your loyalty is not to me, but to the stars above. One more.
Let's come back to Hard Rain, and maybe you could nominate a couple of versions that we should talk about and listen to, I mean, that are different, and perhaps hazard guesses as to why they should be so different, what he's doing when he changes melodies and, you know, sometimes removes the melody and turns a song into a chant.
Yeah. So there are three that I can think of off the top of my head. I survey many in the later chapters of the book. The first one is at the Concert for Bangladesh in 1971, when Dylan was in the midst of this hiatus from touring. But George Harrison, they were like besties around the time. George Harrison convinced him to participate in the Concert for Bangladesh, and Dylan was actually really nervous and almost didn't go on stage. And the first song he sang was Hard Rain.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? Stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. Stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
On the surface, it seems maybe not that different. He's playing an acoustic guitar. And he's backed really quietly by Leon Russell and George Harrison. Leon Russell's playing bass, George Harrison is playing slide guitar, and Ringo Starr's like ostensibly tapping a tambourine, but you can hardly hear it. And yet the performance style is so different. In the 1962 studio recording, a kind of straight-backed severity to it. It's austere. It has an Old Testament kind of seriousness to it. It's, in 1971, this countrified understatement.
It's a hard, it's a hard,
Sort of casual. He was already starting to feel burdened by his own back catalog and burdened by how much the musical world had invested in it. And these were songs that he was expected to perform, and yet sometimes he felt alienated from them. So I think one way to reclaim it is, I'm not going to sing it as some sort of severe, you know, Old Testament vision. I'm going to sing it as sort of a Hank Williams, with little telling breaks in the voice and country ornaments.
It's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. Body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart.
Bob Dylan singing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall at the concert for Bangladesh in 1971. It's a song that he performs also on the Rolling Thunder tour, Steve.
That's right. So in 1975, Dylan goes on tour with this kind of ragtag bunch of celebrities, and they show up in small towns in the northeast of the U.S. and perform these long concerts that are really praised by Dylan fans. And here, Hard Rain becomes something utterly different. It becomes, it's sort of blasphemous.
Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. What did I've crawled on 6 crooked highways? Been in the middle of 7 sad forests.
There's nothing sacred about this performance. It's this raucous roadhouse blues. The original melody is long gone.
And it's a high. Well, it's a high. Well, it's a high. And it's a high. Well, it's a hard rain gonna fall. What did you see? My blue-eyed son, what did you see, my darling young one? Saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. Saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. Saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. Saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. Saw a white ladder covered in water. Saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues are all broken. Guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hive. Well, it's a hive. Well, it's a hive. And it's a hive. Oh, it's a hard rain gonna fall.
The groove is utterly different, and it's anchored by, of all people, Mick Ronson, who was the guitarist in The Spiders from Mars. And the riff that Mick Ronson is playing is a classic Chicago blues stop-time riff that you have in songs like Manish Boy and Hoochie Coochie Man and so forth. But Mick Ronson had most recently been playing it in The Gene Genie, the David Bowie hit. And so we have this kind of wild re-signifying of the song as no longer kind of straight-backed prophetic. It's instead this kind of rollicking sacrilege.
Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? child beside a dead pony. Met a white man who walked a black dog. Met one woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man wounded in love. Met another man wounded in hatred. And it's a high, well it's a high, well it's a high, and it's a high, and it's a hard rain on the bow.
Also, I should mention, this eventually is placed into Dylan's much hated, at least at the time, film, Rinaldo and Clara, a four-hour film. And he puts the Hard Rain live clip right after a clip of some street preachers. So there is still some connection to kind of like crazy fanatics on the street hollering at you about Jesus or something. And so maybe there's still some of that prophetic energy here, but it has this real sacrilegious vibe.
There's also a connection, who knows if it's intentional, with Steve Reich and his street preacher going, it's going to rain, it's going to rain.
It's going to rain, 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 it's
going to
rain.
That's right, yeah, indeed.
Maybe Dylan meant it. You never know, do you, with Dylan? That's the thing.
Yeah, right, that's the thing.
When the executioner's face is always well hidden, when the hunger is ugly, when souls are forgotten, when black is the color, none is the number. And I'll tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it. Reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. Then I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, well it's a hard. It's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall.
That's Dylan on the Rolling Thunder Tour and A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. I'm talking on today's music show to Stephen Ring, who's the author of What Did You Hear? The Music of Bob Dylan. Give us one more example.
So the last one I'd mention is a performance that's beloved by fans from 1994. It's Dylan performing in front of an orchestra, the only time he's ever done it, on this big concert that was called the Experience Music Project, that was arranged by this guy, Tony Hollingsworth, where he brought in a whole collection, a sort of odd motley group of artists ranging from Joni Mitchell to Ry Cooder to INXS to Bob Dylan, including like Japanese taiko drummers. There's a very world new age vibe to it. Dylan performs three songs with an orchestra conducted by Michael Kamen, and the one that everyone loves is this version of Hard Rain, which is really extraordinary.
What do you hear in my blue-eyed song? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. Walking out proud on 6 crooked highways. Stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. Out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain in a fall. Why don't you see my blue eyes, son?
There are a couple things about it. One, Dylan famously is a shambolic performer. He drops beats all the time. He adds beats. He changes the meter here and there and so forth. This is both his musical temperament, that's just how he does as a musician. But it's also very much plugged into certain traditions in the American folk revival where there are traditions of dropping beats. Well, when you're singing with an orchestra, you can't drop beats. When he's playing with a band, he can, and if you're gonna keep your job in Bob Dylan's band, you need to be able to respond on a dime when he drops a beat. Like, everyone is watching like a hawk, and they know to adjust. Well, an orchestra can't adjust. So he needs to be quite disciplined in how he sings the song. And as a result, he turns in this really affecting performance that is both anthemic, but also fragile, and it seems always just on the edge of maybe it's not going to hold together. And the fact that it does is really moving.
Why don't you hear my blue-eyed song? Or did you hear my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder and it roared out of warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard the 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. I had 10,000 whispering, nobody listening. I had one person starve, I had many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown and a crying in the alley. And it's a hard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard breeze. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son?
One thing I mention in the book is we can imagine any number of more conventional singers singing this song in front of an orchestra. I mentioned, like, Michael Bolton, if you dare. Like, Michael Bolton would sing it super confidently, right? And nobody would be going on YouTube and saying, oh my God, I cry when I hear this, or this is the best version of this song ever. And so I think here the fragility of his voice in front of this orchestral mass is part of the effect. The other thing I'll say is that he finds his way back into the melody of the song and kind of unlocks a whole new way of performing it that he will then unfurl in the coming years. And he even said, coming off the stage, that's the best I've sung in, I can't remember, it was 15 years or something like that. So he knew he'd done something special.
And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and my guest is Stephen Rings, who is the author of What Did You Hear? The Music of Bob Dylan. We've heard Bob Dylan now with an orchestra and doing the best singing of 15 years. Maybe we should talk about some of the imperfections in his voice, some of the flawed words and stubborn sounds of that Wallace Stevens quote that you have at the beginning of the book, because you maintain that he introduces these, that he knows what he's doing much of the time, that he's, when he drops a beat, for instance, that it's not just that he can't count.
Yeah, I mean, this is a delicate point. What I don't want to be taken as saying is that he's sitting down and calculating and saying, well, you know, I should drop this beat right here. That's going to make it sound like I'm unsure or whatever. I think there is part of his musical constitution that is just that way. He is also a very intuitive musician, so he knows when a take works and when it doesn't by his lights. And I think often that's where we see some of the judgment enter in. One really telling instance where I think this comes into focus is in a song called I Believe in You, which is from his Christian era. It's from 1979. And he breaks his voice at the same moment every time. And tellingly, it's not a moment where he needs to break his voice. He can sing higher than that just fine. But he does it every time on the studio recording. And if you listen to recordings from later that year that are live, he does it there too. I don't know if he was thinking strategically, consciously about this, but this is obviously a way of showing a kind of faltering faith or showing the difficulty of maintaining belief in the face of all of the disapproval of all of his friends, which is what the song is really about. So that's one instance, but there are many others too. I think one of the things he realized is that his musical way of being is loaded with errant sounds, and he has found ways to recruit them for aesthetic effect. I think that would be the best way I can put it.
The extent to which Dylan is doing things on purpose and calculating the effect is something which, you know, there's a whole conversation there as well, which we don't really have time for. I mean, he is occasionally accused of sabotaging his own career. It's a bit late for that now, but one of the examples of the sabotage is in 1983 when he releases this album Infidels, the first album following these three Christian albums. And it opens with the wonderful, beautiful, melodic Joker Man, which has even melismas on it. You don't get many of them with Bob Dylan. But he leaves off a song which many people feel is one of his greatest songs ever, Blind Willie McTell. And I'd like us to finish by talking about this song, and perhaps you might like to speculate why it's not on the album.
That's one that I don't have a good answer for. And this has vexed just about everybody with an interest in Bob Dylan. The unsexy answer is this is a period where he's pretty uncertain about a lot of things. We're near the nadir of his career as he identifies it. I would put it at Live Aid, but he talks in Chronicles about being lost in these years and really having lost his way. And I think some of his judgment in the studio, second guessing, might have led to this decision. It also could be that he recognized that this was a really important song, and he wasn't satisfied with the versions that he and Mark Knopfler recorded. Mark Knopfler was one of his collaborators on the record. The reason that I'd shy away from that answer is that if that were the case, he would return to the song and record it on a later album. He also has other songs that, as he puts it, get away from him. He loses them. So one of these would be Caribbean Wind, which is another 80s song that's amazing and better than a lot of the stuff that's on the albums, but he can never quite get it into focus and it drifts away. Much earlier in the 60s, The Great White Whale is this song called She's Your Lover Now from around the time of Blonde on Blonde. The torsos we have of that are just spectacularly great. Dylan at his nastiest, but like most delightfully nasty. This was more in the songwriting. Like I couldn't find a way to complete it. It just fell apart and I couldn't do it. That doesn't seem to be the case with Blind Willie McTell, which is a pretty complete song. And the two versions I discuss in the book, studio versions of it, I think are magnificent. One of them has a full band. The other one has just him at the piano and Mark Knopfler on 12-string guitar, and they both have their marvels.
Maybe we should start with the band version and listen to the opening, which is remarkably free.
I seen the arrow on the doorpost saying this land is condemned.
It's almost like in church, this is like the organist who plays a couple chords to get the key in the ears of the congregation. So he does that a little bit, and then he begins to sing very freely.
And I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McDowell.
The moment I think is really magical is when we hear, if you listen closely, just as he sings when they were taking down the tents, you hear his foot start to tap.
As they were taking down the tents, the stars above the barren trees was his only audience. Them charcoal gypsy maidens can strut their feathers well, but nobody can sing the blues like Blind Willie McDowell.
And this is one of the things you can do easily when you're playing the piano, is tap your foot audibly. And this gives the band a cue. And they sneak in stealthily. And it's just this marvelous moment where the whole thing coalesces and you didn't expect it to lock in.
Blind Willie McDowell is the title of the album. Blind Willie McDowell is one of the great Piedmont blues artists of the early 20th century. It doesn't sound like Willie McDowell, does it, at all?
Not at all. The only nod I can see to the sound of Blind Willie McDowell is the fact that Mark Knopfler plays an acoustic 12-string on the second version. And that was Blind Willie McDowell's instrument. He played the 12-string guitar.
It's Ralph McTell's instrument as well. Maybe there's a connection there.
That's right. Yeah. The 12-string club. But Knopfler doesn't play it anything like Blind Willie McDowell is doing. And I, by the way, I would imagine that Mark Knopfler is capable of that. He's such an extraordinary guitarist. But instead, we get this very sober performance from Knopfler and Dylan on the second version. The one thing to mention about this that I make some hay about in the book is the key is E flat minor. So for non-musicians, that might not mean much. For guitarists, especially guitarists imagining playing a 12-string guitar, I'm sure any guitarist is thinking, oh my God, you know, what am I going to do with E-flat minor? The guitar is an instrument that works very well in E minor. E minor is actually the easiest key in the guitar, on the guitar. So if you're going to play an E-flat minor, you either have to play a bunch of really uncomfortable stuff way up on the neck, which on a 12-string is very hard, or you've got to tune the whole thing down a semitone, which is what Mark Knopfler had to do. So spare a thought for Mark Knopfler or his guitar tech having to retune 12 strings down to E-flat minor. But the reason that it's in that key is that Bob Dylan, when he's playing the piano, which he is doing here, loves playing on the black keys. He even talks about this. He's not the only one. There are other songwriters. Irving Berlin, for example, played mostly the black keys on the piano. He had a piano that transposed so he could just keep his fingers there, but then transpose it so it would make different sounds. But a key like E-flat minor has Dylan's hands resting on the black keys much of the time. This sort of malevolent cloud that hangs over this version comes from this resounding E-flat minor chord that he's playing in his right hand over and over again.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem.
It's a hymn-like version, isn't it? This, I think you just used the word solemn.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of hymnic as well. You know, one thing that's striking to me about it that ties into that hymnic quality is rhythm. We were just talking about the various times when Dylan drops beats or the rhythm is wobbly in one way or another. Earlier in the chapter, when I talk about this song, a song I talk about before it is called Time Passes Slowly from the album New Morning. And there, Dylan's piano playing is just super irregular, bumpy, awkward, difficult to lock in. And there it fits well with a lyric that's about being in sort of pastoral retreat and trying to get your head right, like trying to, you know, bliss out in nature. And the piano says, well, maybe it's harder to do that than one would like. So sometimes he'll choose a take, which is what he does there, that's really irregular. And even though I don't think he deliberately dropped beats when he was playing, he listened to it and thought, ah, this fits the mood of this song better than these other versions with the band that are really metrically confident. Blind Willie McTell, from A Dozen Years Later, is rhythmically just from a different universe. It has a kind of TikTok regularity that plugs into that hymnic structure that suggests a kind of inexorable process underway, or a time scale that's much broader, that is sort of moving ineluctably forward. And that fits with this song that's so much about historical suffering around slavery, around the original sin of the New World.
See them big plantations burning. Hear the cracking of the whips. Smell that sweet magnolia blooming. See the ghost of slavery's ship.
We have left out so much that you write about in your book, including the approach of Dylan to melody. You talk about his writing of chant songs and his contour inventive style and his use of conventional melody, which I guess is Blind Willie McTell, except that in this case, and this is something else I had never noticed, even though I know St. James Infirmary very, very well, and I had certainly noticed the reference to the St. James Hotel in the song, but I'd never spotted the fact that Blind Willie McTell is actually loosely based on that old St. James Infirmary blues.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, and you think, well, you know, maybe this is sort of a loose, remote connection when I listen to them back to back, but actually it's really patent. It's not just the chords, it's the melody, too.
I can hear them rebels yell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell.
Stephen Rings, thank you for being my guest on The Music Show, and thank you for writing the book as well.
Well, thank you so much.
What Did You Hear? The Music of Bob Dylan is published by Chicago University Press. The Music Show is made on Gadigal, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung country, produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham, with technical production from Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. Coming up, we get to talk to Zoe Knighton from the Flinders Quartet and composer Melody Ertvers about their five-year plan.
Well, God is in his heaven, and we all want what's his. But power and greed and corruptible sin seem to be all that there is. Hotel.